Now, it may be, as Milton mentioned, that some in democratic South Africa today are too young to remember apartheid firsthand, but I guarantee you that no one in Egypt has forgotten this. The crowds in Tahrir Square leading the mostly peaceful Egyptian revolution 4 years ago. It was a highlight of the Arab Spring, but it's been a bumpy ride for Egypt ever since. And today there was a painful reminder that things are not well there. A group affiliated with the so-called Islamic State claimed responsibility for a series of attacks that killed nearly 36 people, mostly policemen and army officers, in the Sinai Peninsula. This was the sort of thing that wasn't supposed to happen under Egypt's new strongman president. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi is depicted by nationalist media as the man who's rescuing the country from Islamic militancy. Thanasi Kambanis was there 4 years ago. He's a longtime Middle East correspondent and author. His new book is called Once Upon a Revolution, an Egyptian Story. And Thanasi joins me now in the studio. You begin your book by saying that you fell in love with the Tahrir Revolution. Why was that?
Everything about that early wave of protests really shattered all my expectations, not just about the Arab world, but about politics and human behavior in general. There was this incredible courage and bravery with which these hundreds of thousands of people stood up to a police state that was willing to kill them to stay in power. But more than that, what these people were in the process of doing, and I could hear this up close in Tahrir and in the years afterwards, they were actually daring to imagine a completely new political system. And I expect that if one could find oneself in colonial America in the time of the Federalist Papers, the conversations going on in bars between the brawls over checks and balances and the design of a new constitution would be a lot like the kinds of conversations I heard in Egypt.
Did you think that what ended up happening was possible?
I didn't think any of it was possible going into it. I had spent a decade in the Arab world, and my expectation was that we were going to get, at best, incremental adjustments, and at worst, more of the same or war and entropy. So the rebellion itself was category-defying, and that whole first 2 years where there really was a tangible possibility, and for a time it seemed like they had made it, not to a perfect system, but from dictatorship, stifling violent dictatorship, to a civilian rule that was going to imperfectly negotiate its way forward. And that was, to my way of thinking, nothing short of a miracle.
Your book focuses on the lives of two men with very different perspectives on the revolution itself. Tell us about that.
One is a former Muslim brother. At the beginning of the revolution, he was a Muslim Brotherhood youth leader. His name is Muaz Abdul Karim, and he came out of this sort of autocratic religious tradition. He was an activist, very good at organizing protests, field clinics under fire, and this sort of thing. He eventually was kicked out of the Brotherhood because he was too independent and too willing to collaborate with secular activists. Today, he's in exile. If he goes back to Egypt, he'll be thrown in prison. And he's still trying, without much luck, to get his secular and Islamist friends to be willing to talk to each other and collaborate against power. The other main character is a guy named Bassem Kamel, who was a 40-year-old architect at the beginning of the uprising, completely apolitical, bourgeois, keeping his head down guy with very modest ambitions. And at age 40, he realized that playing by the rules was sending his family into poverty and leaving him feeling completely humiliated and undignified. He became a political activist, ran for parliament, one of only four revolutionary activists who made it in, and he's running for parliament again today.
And this is what was so exciting about the revolution, is you got these two disparate guys, lots of disparate people coming together for one common cause.
Yeah, you had working class people, uneducated people, rich bourgeois people. This recipe, which ultimately fractured over personal disputes and religious disputes, but this recipe for change, which was we can all agree that torture is wrong. We can all agree that military dominance is wrong. And for a time, they said, we can get together to fight those things and try and put accountability into our government, and then we can fight over the spoils. But unfortunately, they started fighting much too soon.
Well, how did the wheels come off the bus?
I view it as a failure that came from two directions. The main responsibility lies with the old regime, which was strong and unscrupulous and used all the tools at its disposal, including killing a lot of dissidents, to fight its way back to power. So the starting point is not that the revolution failed, but that it was crushed and defeated. But it did have a lot of failings and shortcomings of its own. The most important ones, I think, were their poverty of ideas and their refusal to choose leaders. So the sort of cult and culture of a leaderless revolution, and this idea, almost like Occupy Wall Street, this idea that we're always going to operate by consensus, left them easily outmaneuvered by the army and the Muslim Brotherhood, who did have hierarchies and leaders.
But when you say the old regime, you mean not just the Mubarak family, but all the apparatus that he'd set up.
The old regime hasn't come back. What we have is a dictatorship has reasserted itself. It's actually something different than the old regime. Mubarak's regime was a coalition of Mubarak's coterie, an oligarchy, some corrupt business people, the military, and the police. Today, we have clearly a military regime. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi rules from a much narrower circle than Mubarak did. And we see in the level of repression and also, frankly, in the lack of creativity, even compared to Mubarak's not very creative regime, that he's drawing on a very, very narrow circle of men.
Okay, so people seem to realize that perhaps putting al-Sisi back in power or allowing this military coup was not the best idea for them, for their country. Where do we go from here? What happens next?
So the core grievances that led Egypt to explode in January 2011, that impossible uprising that turned very quickly into a daily reality, all those core grievances are still present. Nothing, unfortunately, about Sisi's methods suggests that he's going to be able to resolve them.
So, and they're what?
So people are profoundly poor. The nation cannot feed itself. The nation cannot pay the fuel it needs to make its buses run and its electricity supply exist. So there are power outages, bread shortages, just most basic things. And then the other, by Egyptian standards, luxuries of life like school and healthcare are also profoundly broken. A genius with real popular governance would have trouble solving these problems. And this dictator is unlikely to be able to do anything to address them. In my assessment, that means that many ruptures are inevitable. There are going to be cycles of popular explosion. I don't think we can assume that they'll go better than the last ones unless and until the political opposition solves these profound disputes, the disputes between secular and Islamist people and the disputes between people who desire an authoritarian military ruler versus those who want a democratic system. Till they repair those rifts, they're going to always be fragmented. So there will be these either waves of protest or, as we saw today, waves of violence against the state. And we're not going to see viable alternatives emerging in those moments to offer the Egyptian people a choice other than military dictatorship.
Thanasi Kambanis, author of Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. Thanks for coming in, man.
Great talking to you, Aaron.
Our newsroom here buzzes away 24/7 on Twitter. We're at PRI The World. For my latest trend-setting updates, you can follow me at World Aaron.